But then I made it clear I wasn't going to hassle them, that I was looking for information. Her voice had gone up on the last word. She was worried she was in trouble again. Jeffrey asked,
Did they talk to you?
Some of them did. Lena had turned tentative again.
Read the room, Lena. I'm not yelling at you.
It's just that half of them said they'd worked on the storage construction site. They get rotated out depending on what's needed. But they said it was weird, because there was a gringo taking money under the table, too.
She paused, waiting for a nod.
They didn't know his name, but everybody called him B.B. And so I pressed, and this one guy said he thought it stood for Big Bit.
Big Bit,
Jeffrey repeated. Something about the name was setting off an alarm.
Like a drill bit?
I'm not sure, Lena said, but it made me think about Felix Abbott because...
Fuck.
Jeffrey sat up so fast his nose ignited.
Felix admitted that he goes by the name Little Bit. There's got to be a Big Bit. And maybe Big Bit is Daryl, and maybe Daryl has access to a van. Where's Felix now? Is he in Holden?
Lena stood up, because he'd stood up.
I checked on my way in. They're getting him ready to bus to the courthouse. His arraignment is this morning.
Go get him. Rip him out of the back of the bus if you have to. Get his arrest jacket from the guard and put him in interrogation. Go.
Lena banged open the door so hard that the glass shook.
Frank?
Jeffrey didn't see him in the squad room. He ran over to the kitchen.
Frank?
Frank looked up. He was standing over the sink, eating a bacon biscuit. Jeffrey said,
Felix Abbott, 23, skateboarder, pot dealer.
Why is his name coming up again?
Crumbs fell out of Frank's mouth.
You looking at him for the attacks?
Should I be?
The family tree is nothing but an oily, turd-filled toilet. But nah. The younger generation squandered the family criminal enterprises. Typical succession issue. By the time you hit the third generation, they don't have the work ethic.
Frank coughed out some more crumbs.
I'd look at the kid's father. One of his...
Jeffrey stepped away from the scattershot as he coughed again.
His uncles, I was saying.
Frank spat into the sink. He turned on the faucet to wash it down.
You got 5 or 6 families in Memminger you look at when anything hinky goes down. The Abbots are at the top of the pile. Though good luck keeping them straight. They all crossbreed like bitches in heat.
Tell me about the Abbots.
Shit. Let me see if I can remember.
Frank coughed again.
If I've got the right shit stains, the grandfather's in Statesville for a double homicide. Granny tried to cover his tracks and wound up with a nickel in Wentworth. They had 6 sons, all of them bar brawlers and wife beaters with so many kids and stepkids and out-of-wedlock kids nobody can keep count.
Any of them named Daryl?
Fuck if I know. They're a Memminger problem. I hear their names and I just laugh.
You seem to know a lot about the family.
I do a monthly choir practice with a deputy over in Memminger. Guy knows how to sing.
When cops talked about choir practice, they meant the kind that took place in a bar, not a church.
Any of the Abbots ever work at the college?
No way they'd pass a background check.
What about the nickname Big Bit? That ever come up?
Nah, but there's a fair amount of imbibing during choir.
Frank admitted.
I can call over to Memminger and do some digging around.
Do it. If I can prove Daryl is a gringo going by the name of Big Bit on the Mercer construction site, that puts him in proximity to the fire road that leads to the Truong crime scene.
Shit.
Shit is right. Get on the phone.
Jeffrey was on his toes, halfway between a fast walk and a run, as he headed toward the interrogation room. Lena was leading Felix Abbott down the hallway. His hands were cuffed behind his back. His feet were shuffling, though his ankles weren't chained. Jeffrey could smell the con on him. This wasn't the first time Felix had been arrested. He had his chest puffed out like a punk daring a cop to take a swing. Jeffrey felt tempted, but he opened the door to interrogation and waited for the kid to go in. Felix snarled his upper lip as he walked by. Shoulders back, chest out. For all his posturing, he looked like a normal 20-something-year-old. Not too tall, not too skinny. Floppy brown hair, just the way Chuck had described him. Felix was dressed like a skateboarder in board shorts, a zip-up hoodie, and faded Ramones t-shirt. The bruise on the side of Felix's head told Jeffrey that Lena had not been playing around when she tackled him off his skateboard. Felix took in Jeffrey's damaged nose, asking, "This bitch knock you around too?" Jeffrey dug the wadded-up pieces of toilet paper out of his nostrils and tossed them into the trash. The room was small, but typical to most cop shops. A table bolted to the floor, chairs on either side, a one-way mirror to a tiny viewing room that doubled as a storage closet. Lena tossed Felix Abbott's arrest jacket onto the table. Jeffrey did not sit down. He stood over the jacket, scanning the details. Felix had been arrested twice before, both for possession, both times receiving nothing more than a slap on the wrist. His tattoos were many. His AKA was Little Bit. According to his driver's license, Felix lived in Memminger. Jeffrey recognized the Doolally address, a Shittsville motel that rented by the week. All he needed from this kid was a name, not even a first name. Jeffrey knew in his gut that finding Daryl would either lead him to a clue or be the clue that broke the case wide open. Jeffrey looked up. Felix was standing at the other end of the table. His jaw was angled up again, inviting a punch. He had a pimple on his chin. The white, pus-filled head stared at Jeffrey like a rheumy eye. Jeffrey said,
"Sit."
Felix took his time shuffling around the table. Lena's hands clamped onto shoulders. She shoved him down into the plastic chair.
"Fuck!"
Felix complained. Jeffrey motioned for her to sit across from Felix. He crossed his arms, glaring down at the kid. Felix looked up at Jeffrey, then back at Lena. She had her arms crossed, too. Jeffrey started out small.
"You were arrested with some dub sex."
"So?"
Felix demanded.
"That's your third arrest for possession. I've already made a call to the district attorney. We're doing this new thing in town where we clamp down on recidivism."
His shoulder jerked up in a shrug.
"So?"
"So you're looking at big boy prison for this, not another stint in county lockup."
His shoulder jerked again. He probably had uncles in prison. His path would be smoother than most. Still, Jeffrey waited for a response. The kid offered a third.
"So?"
Lena's hand whipped out. She gave Felix an open palm slap across the face.
"Jesus fuck, lady!"
Felix's hands went to his face. He looked at Jeffrey.
"What the fuck, man?"
Jeffrey nodded. Lena slapped him again.
"What?"
Felix shouted.
"What do you want?"
Jeffrey said,
"You go by the name Little Bit."
He rethought his answer.
"Is that a crime?"
Jeffrey asked.
"Where'd you get the nickname?"
"From I don't know, one of my uncles. I was little. They were all big."
"Big."
"Jesus!"
Felix rubbed his cheek.
"What is up with you, bitch?"
Jeffrey snapped his fingers for Felix's attention.
"Don't worry about her. Look at me."
"What else should I be worried about, dude?"
He kept his hand to his face as he told Lena,
"You need to stop, okay? It really stinks."
Jeffrey drew in a breath of air. He wanted to shake this little shit until his teeth fell out. But the worst way to get information was to let the suspect know you needed it. He pressed his knuckles into the table and leaned over.
"You want me to hit you instead?"
Felix shook his head so hard that the hair flopped to the other side. Jeffrey glared down at him. Was he wrong about Daryl being their most likely suspect? Was Felix the man who had attacked Becky Catarino? Who had kicked a hammer between Leslie Truong's legs so hard that the head had splintered off?
"I need a doctor!"
Felix kept rubbing his cheek. His bottom lip had pouted out. If he was a psychopath, he was a damn good one. Jeffrey asked,
"Where were you 2 days ago between the hours of 5 and 7 in the morning?"
2 days?
Felix pushed his hair back into place.
"Shit, dude, I don't know. Asleep in my bed?"
Lena took out her notebook and pen. Felix looked nervous at the prospect of going on the record. Jeffrey prompted,
"You were asleep 2 days ago between the hours of 5 and 7 in the morning?"
Maybe.
He looked at Lena, then Jeffrey.
"I don't know, dude. One day I woke up in the drunk tank over in Memminger. I don't know if that was then."
Jeffrey watched Lena make a dash beside the note to follow up on the possible alibi. He told Felix,
"The director of campus security identified you as a known pot dealer."
Felix didn't offer a rebuttal. Jeffrey asked,
"You were at the college yesterday?"
"Yeah, dude."
Felix brushed back his hair again.
"I was busting Benihanas outside the library. The security guards, you slip them a 5 and they look the other way."
Jeffrey wasn't surprised Chuck's men were taking bribes. He looked down at Lena's notebook. She had made another dash to check the security footage outside the library. He asked Felix,
"Do you ever go into the woods?"
"What?"
Felix looked repulsed.
"No, man. You can't skate in the woods. There's dirt and shit."
"Does anybody else in your family have nicknames?"
"Yeah, so?"
He jerked back at the last minute, expecting another slap.
"What the fuck is up with you people? I thought you were gonna offer me a deal."
"A deal for what?"
"Like, I don't know. My supplier?"
"No deals,"
Jeffrey said.
"Tell me about the nicknames."
Felix was confused enough to answer.
My gramps is called Bumpy on account of he bumped off a few guys. I got an uncle called Rip because he can rip a fart. There's Bubba, Bubba Sausage.
Jeffrey let him go through the list. He wasn't surprised it was long. Men gave each other nicknames. He'd been called Slick in high school. His best friend had been called Possum. Felix said,
"My Uncle Axel's doing a stint at Wheeler, which is kind of funny. Axel Wheels, you get it?"
Jeffrey had gathered from Frank that the Abbotts weren't into family planning. It was possible that Felix had an uncle who was close to his own age. He asked,
"How long has Axel been inside?"
3 months? I don't know. You guys can look it up."
Jeffrey watched Lena make another dash to follow up. He asked Felix,
"Does Axel work on cars?"
"Sure. That's why they call him that. Dude wasn't born at Wheeler."
Jeffrey thought of the dead blow kit, the cross-peen hammer.
"Does he do body work, fix dents and scratches?"
"He works on anything, man. Dude's a motorhead genius. He even knows how to fix skateboards."
Jeffrey took a mental step back. He only had one chance with this kid.
"You two must be close if he's working on your skateboards."
"Nah, man. Axel never did shit for me. Can't stand my guts."
Jeffrey had started to sweat. He could feel he was close.
"Who does Axel fix skateboards for?"
"His son, Only the dude isn't really his son, like, he never adopted him, even after his mom died.
Felix shook his hair out of his eyes. He was clearly more comfortable with this line of questioning, which is exactly what Jeffrey wanted.
My cuz, he's the one who got me into skating. I've been his shadow since forever. Dude was there when I pulled off my first alley-oop.
My cuz. Lena had looked up from her notebook. Felix's eyes darted her way. Jeffrey weighed his options. They could do a search for Felix's uncles, find the one nicknamed Axel who was in Wheeler State Prison, then drive over there and try to sweat the information out of the con. Or Jeffrey could join Frank on the phones and call around and see if anyone knew about the kid Axel had raised, who wasn't legally his son. Or Jeffrey could get the answer from this punk little jackass right now. Again, he circled around the target, asking Felix,
"What's an alley-oop?"
"Dude, it's awesome. You spin to one side and air to the other like a fish breaking out of water."
"Sounds hard."
"Oh, no doubt. You can get a gnarly hipper."
"What's your cousin's name?"
Like a switch being flipped, Felix's demeanor changed. He was no longer in laid-back skater mode. He was a kid from a criminal family who lived in a bad part of town, who knew you didn't rat out your own blood.
"Why?"
Jeffrey knelt down, putting himself at Felix's level.
"They call him Big Bit, right? And you're Little Bit, because you're his shadow."
Felix's eyes darted back to Lena, then to Jeffrey, then back again. He was trying to figure out if he had given too much away. Jeffrey could only guess at the connections he was trying to make. He needed the words from Felix. He lifted his chin at Lena, indicating she should leave. Lena folded her notebook closed. She clicked her pen. She walked out the door. Jeffrey took his time standing up. He walked slowly to Lena's chair in order to give her time to take position behind the one-way mirror. He sat down. He gripped his hands together on the table. He tried to keep his options open, saying,
"Daryl's not in any trouble."
"Shit."
Felix's foot started tapping against the floor.
"Shit, shit, shit, shit."
Jeffrey took that as confirmation that he was on the right track. He tried to put himself in Felix's position. He wasn't going to flip on his cousin.
At least, not on purpose. "Felix, I'm going to be straight with you. This is about the construction site on Mercer."
The tapping stopped.
"The storage place?"
"The feds are getting involved because of OSHA violations."
Jeffrey felt the lie spreading like a drug through his brain.
"Do you know what an OSHA investigation means?"
"They, like, come in when people are hurt on the job because the bosses are cutting corners."
"That's right,"
Jeffrey said.
"OSHA is looking for witnesses against the bosses. They know Big Bit was working on the side. They want to talk to him off the record."
His hands came up together because of the handcuffs. He picked at the pimple on his chin.
"How bad were people hurt?"
"Really bad."
Jeffrey debated which way to push. Would the offer of a fake reward be too obvious? Should he go back to skateboarding? In the end, Jeffrey chose silence, which was just as hard for him to pull off as it was for Felix to suffer through. The kid broke first, saying,
"I don't want to jam up my cuz, yo."
Jeffrey leaned forward.
"Are you worried about his rap sheet?"
Felix's expression gave him the confirmation. His cousin had an arrest jacket, possibly an outstanding warrant or two. That was why Big Bit had been working on the job site for cash, like the other undocumented day laborers. He couldn't risk his social security number going into the system. Jeffrey said,
"I don't care if he's been in trouble before. That's not what this is about."
"You don't get it, dude. I told you. I've been like his shadow since I was a little grommet."
Jeffrey gave up on the lie. He went with a more reliable motivator, self-interest.
All right, Felix. How badly do you want a deal? You haven't been arraigned yet. I could kick the charge on the dub sacks. Hell, I could lose the paperwork. Just give me his name, and you could walk out of here right now.
Felix started digging at the pimple again. Jeffrey breathed through his broken nose. He could hear a slight whistle. This was going nowhere. He was going to have to make a decision. He gave the kid one last chance.
Well?
Well, what?
Felix had turned angry.
He's not even my real cousin, okay? My Uncle Axe shacked up with his mom for like a minute before she OD'd, and then he was stuck with him. I mean, we're close, but we're not technically related. We don't even have the same last name.
Jeffrey clenched his jaw, waiting.
Okay. Yeah,
Felix finally said.
He's been staying at Axel's house, right? Like, I'm stuck in Doolally with damn meth freaks, and he's living it up in Avondale rent fucking free.
I need his name, Felix.
Nesbitt, Felix said. Daryl Nesbitt.
Jeffrey felt his lungs open for the first time in 2 days. He had almost a full second of relief before the door banged open.
Chief,
Frank said,
I need you.
Jeffrey stood up. He felt off balance. Daryl Nesbitt. He needed to go back at Felix, figure out why Katerino and Truong had Daryl's number in their phones. Was Daryl part of the pop business? Were the phone numbers enough of a justification to bring Daryl into the station? Nesbitt had worked at the job site near the fire road. His father fixed damaged cars. Axel Abbott probably had a dead blow hammer set in his toolbox, a toolbox that his stepson could be holding on to while his dad was in prison. Did Daryl have access to a dark-colored van? Was he in the vicinity of the college over the last 2 days? Jeffrey would need cell phone records, credit card statements, arrest records, social media.
Over here.
Frank pulled him down the hall. Something was wrong. Jeffrey tried to shut down the list in his head, telling Frank,
I already got Daryl's.
The dean just called,
Frank said.
Another student is missing.
Atlanta, Chapter 22.
Ugh.
Faith looked up from her phone, giving herself a break from reading so she didn't get carsick. Will was driving while she searched police reports, newspaper articles, and social media to pull together a profile of Callie Zanger. Faith had gone into the task thinking that she would prove that Miranda Newberry and her 80-tab color-coded spreadsheet was wrong, but everything so far pointed to a victim who had somehow managed to get away. Will asked,
Well?
First off, Callie Zanger is freaking beautiful. Will pulled his eyes away from the road to look at the photo on Faith's phone. He didn't say anything, but he didn't have to. Zanger was gorgeous. Long, thick hair, perfect button nose, a chin that could cut diamonds. She probably got up at 4 every morning to do Pilates and update her vision board. Faith's vision board was a tattered photograph of her sleeping. She gave Will the summary. Zanger is a named partner at a white shoe law firm called Guthrie, Hodges, and Zanger. Divorced, no children. She specializes in tax litigation. 41 years old. Lives in a $6 million penthouse at one museum across from the High. Was reported missing 2 years ago. March 28th.
Early morning?
Will asked. Probably. She missed a mandatory Wednesday morning meeting. Apparently, she's a real type A. Never misses a meeting. So, everybody freaked. Called the hospitals, the cops, went by her place, checked her gym. Her BMW was in the garage. Zanger's mother, Veronica Houston Bailey, was at the downtown Atlanta precinct by noon with her family lawyer, which is why I'm assuming APD didn't tell her to come back in 24 hours.
Houston Bailey of Houston Bailey Realtors?
That's the one. The firm was by far the largest commercial real estate company in Atlanta. For what it's worth, I agree with APD moving fast on this. High-powered, politically connected female attorneys don't just disappear like that, especially when they're in the middle of a very nasty zillion-dollar divorce that's in the papers and on the news every day.
Did APD go with the husband?
Rod Zanger. And yes, they went at him like a pack of velociraptors. Rod claimed he had no idea where she was, why she was missing, all the usual. But he couldn't account for his whereabouts the Wednesday morning she disappeared. No receipts, no phone records, no alibi witnesses. He said he was home in their Buckhead mansion with a cold, on the maid's day off, and the gardener's. APD were really looking at him hard.
Was her car garaged at work?
In her space at one museum, conveniently located in a blind spot the security cameras didn't cover. She walked to work sometimes if the weather was good. But her purse and phone were found locked in the trunk.
That sounds familiar.
Almost like a pattern, she asked. Do you remember the divorce? It was pretty big, a reverse Cinderella story. They met at Duke Law School. Rod was the poor cowboy from Wyoming. Callie was the wealthy southern debutante who swept him off his feet. The papers called him a kept man. Will shook his head because he only read car magazines and magazines about cars. Faith had gotten a text. She held up her phone in front of her face instead of the other way around. Jeremy was still begging for her help. She swiped away the request, telling Will, "Here's where it gets interesting. 36 hours after Zanger was reported missing, she was found wandering along Cascade Road in the middle of the night. Dazed and confused, blood was pouring from a head wound. Her clothes were torn. She was covered in mud. Her shoes were missing. At the hospital, they treated her for a severe concussion and exposure."
"What kind of head wound?"
he asked.
"Hammer-shaped?"
"The police report doesn't specify, and the newspaper stories are annoyingly vague. But Zanger was taken to Grady, and Sarah used to work there, so..."
"You want her to violate patient privacy?"
Faith pivoted away from that pipe dream. "Zanger signed herself out of the hospital the next morning. According to the papers, there's no record of her being admitted to any other metro hospitals. According to APD, she refused to file an official statement or to even submit to an informal interview. She wouldn't talk to anybody. The husband wouldn't talk. The mother sure as shit wouldn't talk. So the investigation was dropped, and the divorce settlement was put under seal, and the newspapers had nothing else to report. And here we are 2 years later." Will asked,
"How did Zanger get from Cascade Road to the hospital?"
"Older couple driving their grandbaby around trying to get her to fall asleep. Which only works on grandbabies, by the way, not on your own children."
"There's a lot of wooded areas near Cascade."
"I want to get a giant satellite map of the state so I can put X's on where the women lived, where they were found, and the last known location where they were seen alive."
"I bet Miranda has a map."
Faith bristled, which was probably why he'd brought it up. "Riddle me this, Batman. If Dirk Masterson was so sure that she was hunting a serial killer, then why didn't she go to the police?"
"Because she knew that exactly what's going to happen would happen."
Faith looked at her phone, responding to Jeremy's text with more attention than was warranted. Will had advocated for letting Miranda and Gerald Catarino work out a legally binding, interest-accruing repayment plan. But Will would have let Bonnie Parker skate so long as she pinky swore she would never rob a bank with Clyde Barrow again. Will said,
"I'm not saying Miranda is an upstanding citizen, but we wouldn't know about any of this without her. She's the one who fed the information to Gerald. Gerald sent them to Nesbitt. Nesbitt got us here.
Thanks for the summary of the last 2 days, Faith said. Miranda Newbury can't even tell the truth about where she's going for lunch. She set up a fake company with a fake name and a fake website and a legitimate bank account so she could cash checks. Do you really think Gerald Catarino is her only victim? Will didn't have an answer this time. Cheater's gonna cheat, Faith reminded him. But seriously, can we talk about the obvious? I'd be damned if I'd be eating at Wendy's and wearing a dress the color of a clown's fart if someone had given me a tax-free windfall of 30 grand. Will's phone started ringing. He tapped the button. Faith said, It's us. You're on speaker. Amanda asked,
How far away are you from Zanger's office?
Faith guessed, 5 minutes.
Sarah's about the same from HQ. The Van Dorns got here early.
Carolina's put them in the conference room. I want you both back here ASAP. Faith assumed they had decided to ask the parents for permission to exhume the body. She decided against pushing Amanda on the serial killer angle again. We're going to hit rush hour. I'm not sure how long it will take for us to get back. Will asked,
What about Brock's files?
Sarah took a preliminary look-see.
Everything is there. The coroner's report, Sarah's original autopsy notes, the labs, photographs, even a video of the crime scene. The blood and urine screens came back negative, but for cannabinoids. Truong was a student. That only goes to reason.
Amanda said,
This is from Sarah. Rohypnol and GHB have short half-lives and undergo rapid metabolism. Thus, the toxicology results in and of themselves can't exclude possible drugging. The symptoms could include one or all of the following. Amnesia, loss of consciousness, a sense of euphoria, a sense of paranoia, and loss of muscle control, meaning legs and arms paralyzed. The effects can linger for 8 to 12 hours.
Will asked,
What about the blue Gatorade? The lab confirmed a sugary substance consistent with a sports drink, blue in color, found in the stomach contents.
Amanda ordered,
Report back immediately after you speak with Zanger.
Wait. Faith couldn't let it go after all. Are you going to ask anything about the serial killer spreadsheet?
I would only ask why not one of my highly trained investigators spotted these possible connections before a civilian posing as a porn detective stumbled across them.
Faith took the dig, because it was clearly meant for her. Do you realize how many cases I could find if I had 60 billion hours to waste in front of my computer? Will gave her the side eye. Amanda said,
The great thing about not learning from your mistakes, Faith, is that you get to keep making them until you do.
Faith opened her mouth. Will ended the call before she could get a word out. He waited a beat, then told Faith,
You know Amanda's probably working this behind the scenes, right?
Faith wasn't going to get into a discussion about Amanda's habit of playing hide-and-seek with information. She liked being the great wizard behind the curtain. Faith was tired of sitting in Dorothy's basket. Will said,
Amanda had a gut feeling about Masterson. That's why she kept pushing on the ISP. She knows this is a serial. You have to trust that she has a plan. She's trying to keep us reined in.
I guess this is the second day in a row. I'm going to have to tell a man that I am not a horse. Will stared ahead at the road.
Zanger was missing for 36 hours. What reason would she have for not filing a report?
Fear, Faith asked, because that was the reason most women didn't report attacks. She offered up the second one. Maybe she was worried no one would believe her.
She had to go to the hospital. There was physical proof that she was injured.
Maybe she didn't want to deal with it. Her divorce was seriously nasty. Her husband was banging strippers. The strippers talked. Then Callie's ex-boyfriend came out with a story about her being an Adderall freak in college. All of this wasn't just local gossip. It made it to the national news. And then, on top of everything else, she gets raped? Faith had been spared that particular trauma, but she'd been a pregnant 15-year-old, back when they still burned witches. She knew what it felt like to have everyone talking about you, judging you, dissecting you like a specimen under a microscope. She told Will, "We don't honestly know what happened to Callie Zanger in the woods. Look at the other side of the coin. She has a stressful, high-powered job. And in the middle of all of that, she's going through a bad divorce where her most intimate details are being shared by strangers. Maybe she couldn't take it anymore. She went into the woods to end it. Whatever she did didn't work, so she changed her mind and walked out. And now she's embarrassed." Will didn't answer immediately.
"Do you believe that's what happened?"
Faith figured a woman like that would disappear into a Four Seasons spa before she walked into the woods. "No."
"Me neither."
Faith tapped her phone over to Google Maps to make sure they were heading in the right direction. Will did not have sat-nav in his ancient Porsche 911. The car was nice inside, hand-restored by Will to its former glory. But unfortunately, those glory days had been before cup holders and global warming. The air conditioner only went as low as warm. "Here," she pointed to the right. "Go down Crescent Avenue. The parking garage is accessed from the back of the building." Will put on the blinker.
"Do we call ahead of time, or show up in her office?"
Faith considered the options as they waited out the light.
"Zanger refused to talk to the cops. She sent Dirk/Miranda a cease and desist letter. She's made it clear that she doesn't want an investigation."
"She's a tax litigator, not a criminal lawyer. A phone call from the GBI would probably rattle the hell out of her,"
he added.
"But us showing up in person?"
Faith said.
"We're talking about freaking out a woman who was probably brutally attacked, right? Like, that was the worst day of her life. And she spent the last 2 years trying to forget about it. And now we're going to show up with our badges and pick at that scab until it bleeds?"
"I can think of three possibilities."
Will counted them out on his fingers.
"She's either traumatized about what happened, and that's why she can't talk about it. Or she's afraid the attacker will come back and hurt her again. Also traumatizing. Or she's scared of the publicity, because she was traumatized by it during her nasty divorce. Or she could be all of those things. But it doesn't matter, because any way you look at it, she's traumatized. And we're trying to force her into doing something she doesn't want to do, which is to talk about what happened."
Faith asked the question that they had both been avoiding.
"What if she was hurt like Tommy Humphrey?"
The car went silent. With very little effort, Faith was able to put herself back in the briefing room this morning. Sarah was holding up the photograph of the splintered wooden end of the hammer. 4 months. 120 days. That was the length of time Tommy Humphrey had to endure before doctors could begin to repair the physical damage to her body. The psychological damage would probably take an eternity. The young woman had tried to hang herself the day Daryl Nesbitt was convicted for possession of child pornography. Amanda had told Sarah to reach out to her. Maybe that wasn't possible. Maybe Tommy Humphrey had finally taken her own life and found peace in her grave. Faith told Will,
"I can't imagine how Tommy Humphrey could have ever moved past what happened to her."
Will cleared his throat.
"Probably by not talking about it."
"Yeah."
The car went quiet again. Faith felt weighted down, like her blood had turned to sand. Will said,
I'll do it."
Faith dialed the main number for Guthrie Hodges and Zanger. She talked to a way too snooty-sounding receptionist, giving her full GBI credentials and asking to speak to Callie Zanger. Will had made the turn into Crescent and was looking for the entrance to the parking garage by the time Zanger came on the line.
"What's this about?"
Zanger's voice sounded as sharp as her chin.
Faith said, "I'm Special Agent."
"I know who you are. What you want?"
Zanger was speaking in a hoarse whisper. She sounded panicked, which was agonizing, but also presented an opening. Faith went with the easiest possibility first.
"I'm sorry to bother you, Miss Zanger, but my boss, the deputy director of the GBI, got a call from a reporter this morning. She referred it to our public relations department, but we needed to follow up with you on a few things."
"What few things?" she demanded. "You say no comment and let it go."
Faith glanced at Will. He had pulled into a parking space on the street. Faith said,
"Unfortunately, we're a government agency. We really don't have the option of a no comment. We are answerable to the people."
"Bullshit," she hissed. "I don't have to."
"I understand that you are under no obligation to talk to me."
Faith tried another possibility.
"I think you want to, though. I think you're scared that what happened to you will happen again."
"You're wrong about that."
She sounded damn sure of herself. Faith said,
"This will be completely off the record."
"There's no such thing as off the record."
"Look."
Faith was out of possibilities. "I'm outside the parking garage to your building. There's a restaurant across the street. I'll be at the bar for the next 10 minutes. Then I'm coming up to your office to talk to you in person."
"God damn you."
The phone banged down twice before Zanger got the receiver into the cradle. Faith felt disgusted with herself. The last thing she had heard was Callie Zanger's pained cry. She put her head in her hands.
"I hate my job,"
Will said.
"She'll expect you to be alone."
"I know."
Faith got out of the car. The sand in her veins continued to weigh her down as she walked toward the trendy-looking restaurant. Loud music was playing on the outdoor patio. She caught her own reflection in the glass door as she opened it. Will was 20 feet behind her, keeping his distance because he didn't want to spook Callie Zanger if she actually showed up. Faith prayed the woman would meet her at the bar. The phone call had probably set off a small explosion inside the office. Showing up in person with Will, flashing their IDs, would be a nuclear detonation. She looked at her watch as she took her place at the empty bar. 9 more minutes. She ordered an iced tea from a bartender wearing a stupid pork pie hat. 7 more minutes. Faith looked around the restaurant. Late afternoon. She was the only person at the bar. Will was one of 3 single men in suits, sitting at 3 separate tables. In Callie Zanger's shoes, Faith would have been furious about the intrusion into her life. But Faith had to think about Pia Dansky's shoes, Joan Feeney's, Shay Van Dorn's, Alexandra McAllister's, Rebecca Catarino's, Leslie Truong's. There were so many victims that Faith could not recall all of their names. She took her phone out of her purse. She accessed Miranda's spreadsheet. 8 years. 19 women. 20 if you added in Tommy Humphrey.
"Detective Mitchell."
Faith didn't correct her on the title. She recognized Callie Zanger from her photos. The tax attorney wasn't wearing as much makeup and her hair was pulled back, but she was still a beautiful woman, even when she slumped down on the bar stool beside Faith. Callie told the bartender,
"Double Kettle 1 with a lime twist."
Faith heard a practiced cadence in the woman's order. She would expect a high-priced tax attorney to be into wine, or even whiskey. Vodka straight from the bottle was a drinker's drink. Callie said,
"Are you with that other detective, Masterson?"
"No, and he's not a detective."
Callie shook her head in distaste.
Let me guess. He's a reporter.
Faith studied the woman. She looked so beaten down. Was she recovering the same way Tommy Humphrey was recovering? Faith silently berated herself for letting her emotions get in the way. She worked to summon her professional reserve.
Ma'am?
The bartender tipped his hat as he placed the vodka double on the bar. Faith looked down at the drink, which was a very generous pour. Callie didn't seem to notice. She stirred the cocktail straw around the glass. She waited for the bartender to leave before telling Faith,
I hate men who wear hats to make up for not having a personality.
Faith immediately liked this woman.
This is about Rod?
Callie asked. Why do you think I'm here about your ex-husband?
Because my ex-husband is the one who abducted me.
Faith watched the woman gulp down half her drink. She didn't know what to do. Rod Zanger had not been any part of any possibilities. She reached for her purse to find her notebook.
Off the record,
Callie said.
That's what you promised on the phone.
Faith closed her purse. Callie finished the drink in one gulp. She signaled for a refill.
Nothing's really off the record, is it?
Faith couldn't lie to this woman.
No.
Callie took the straw out of her empty glass and slid it end over end against the bar.
I was 13 years old the first time a man touched me without my permission.
Faith watched the straw slip through the woman's fingers.
I was getting my teeth cleaned, and the dentist grabbed my breasts. I never told anybody.
She looked at Faith.
Why didn't I tell anybody?
Faith shook her head. She had her own story she could tell.
Because he'd call you a lying bitch?
Callie laughed.
They call me that anyway.
Faith laughed too, but she was putting the clues together.
Did your husband hurt you?
Callie nodded slowly, almost imperceptibly. Faith bit her tongue to hold back the rush of questions. Will was so much better at leaning into silence. All Faith could do was sip her iced tea and wait. The bartender returned. He did the hat tip, placed a double vodka on the bar. This time, the pour wasn't just generous. It was more like a triple. He saw Faith looking and winked before walking away. Callie stared down at the clear liquid. She had started chewing the inside of her lip.
I found one of those GPS things on my car.
This was 2 years ago?
Yes. During my divorce.
Callie started turning the glass in a circle.
The transceiver was in a black metal box, attached by a magnet to the wheel well. I don't know why I checked for it.
Well, yes, actually, I do. I felt like I was being watched. I knew Rod wouldn't let me go.
Faith asked, Did you tell anyone about it at the time?
My divorce lawyer.
She looked up at Faith.
Always listen to your lawyer. They know best.
Faith gathered from her tone that she was being sarcastic.
She told me to leave it on the car, exactly where I found it. She didn't want to tip off Rod. We wanted to maintain privilege, so her office contracted directly with an IT guy to try to trace the device. He finally told us that he couldn't get the information without a subpoena, and filing a subpoena would tip off Rod, so...
Faith longed for her notebook. If Callie gave her attorney permission to break privilege, Faith could have a subpoena within hours. She asked Callie,
How did it happen?
I was sitting in my car, about to drive to work.
I had a meeting, but...
She waved her hand, brushing it all away.
I don't think it was actually Rod who did it. He must have hired someone. He always liked to watch my face when he was beating me. This guy didn't want to be seen.
Callie took a long pull from her glass. She thumped it down on the counter. Her hands weren't shaking, but they were unsteady. She said,
I can still see it, you know, the hammer. I happened to look up into the rear view mirror.
I have no idea why. I saw this hammer swinging down. It was strange looking, the head of the thing. I've done so many internet searches looking for what to call it, but there are hundreds of different hammers. And they've got fiberglass handles and wooden ones, and this hammer is for framing, and that hammer is for drywall. And do you know, there are even YouTube videos that show the best way to knock out someone with a hammer.
Faith shook her head, pretending like her heart had not dropped into her stomach. The last week of March, the early morning hour, the hammer. Callie signaled the bartender for another, telling him,
"Bring one for my friend, too."
Faith tried to stop her. Callie asked,
"Are you off the record or not?"
Faith nodded for the man to bring two drinks. Callie watched the bartender walk to the other end of the bar. She said,
"He's got a nice ass."
Faith didn't care about the man's ass. The air had folded in around them. She looked in the mirror. Will was still sitting at the table across the room. He was holding his phone in his hand, but his eyes were on the bar. Faith asked Callie,
"What's the next thing you remember?"
"I woke up in the woods, of all places."
She took a breath. "Our first date was a picnic on the grounds of the Biltmore. Rod was always clever that way. He knew he couldn't impress me with a fancy restaurant or a private club. He gave me something that money couldn't buy. Homemade sandwiches, chips, paper napkins, plastic cups. He even wrote me a poem. My romantic cowboy." She had moved away from that moment in the woods. Faith let her stray. "The first time Rod hit me, we were a week away from getting married. He knocked the hell out of me. Literally rang my bell."
She stared longingly into the empty glass. "And then he cried like a baby. And it broke my heart.
This big, strong cowboy was sobbing with his head in my lap, begging me to forgive him, promising me it would never, ever happen again, and I just..."
Faith listened to her voice trail off. There was a tinge of sadness in her tone. Callie Zanger was a smart woman. She knew the exact point in her life when everything had turned bad. She glanced at Faith.
"You've heard this old story before, right?
As a police officer."
Faith nodded.
"It's so embarrassing how they all work from the same boring, predictable playbook,"
she explained.
"They cry and you forgive them. Then eventually they realize that crying isn't going to work anymore. So they make you feel guilty. And then the guilt stops working and they resort to threats. And before you know it, you're terrified of leaving and terrified of staying. And 15 years has gone by and..."
Faith couldn't let her trail off again.
"What made you finally leave him?"
"I got pregnant."
She gave a thin smile.
"Rod didn't want children."
Faith didn't have to ask what had happened. Kelly was right. She had heard this story countless times before.
"It was a blessing, honestly. I couldn't protect myself. How could I protect a child?"
The bartender made his third appearance. This time he skipped the hat tip. He put down the two glasses with a practiced twist of his wrists. Faith gathered he had seen Callie in here before. He knew that a double meant a triple. He more than likely knew he would be well compensated for the charade. Callie told Faith,
"Drink up."
Faith wrapped her hand around the glass. The liquid was cold. She pretended to take a sip. Callie took in a mouthful. She was two triples in and on the cusp of tipsy. Faith wondered if she'd had something else before coming down to the restaurant. Her eyelids were heavy. She kept chewing the inside of her lip.
"Rod toyed with me during the divorce," Callie said. "I thought I was losing my mind."
Faith feigned another sip. "When we were married, he always checked after me to make sure I put things back where they belonged. If something was out of place. She didn't have to finish the sentence. When I moved out, when I got my own space, I just thought, I'm going to be messy. I'm going to drop my clothes on the floor and leave the milk out and throw caution to the wind. Her laugh sounded like crystal breaking. You know what happens when you leave the milk out? She gave Faith an eye roll. I had 15 years of training. I couldn't break the neat freak habit. It made me too nervous. And I like knowing where things are. But suddenly, things were not where they were supposed to be. Faith felt a tightness in her chest. Like what? Oh, I don't know. Maybe everything was actually really where it was supposed to be. There was a comedian who had this joke about breaking into people's apartments and moving their things 1 centimeter away from where they should actually be. Isn't that crazy? Faith didn't answer. I just felt scrutinized. Callie didn't seem satisfied with the word. As if someone had been through my things, touched my things. Nothing was missing. But then one day, suddenly, I couldn't find my favorite hair tie. Faith's hand tightened round her glass. My hair tie, Callie repeated, as if to highlight the insignificance. I reached into my purse for it, and it wasn't there. And I just went mental. I tore the place apart, searching for it everywhere, but it was gone. What did it look like? Just a red hair tie. She shrugged. I paid a few $100 for it. Faith looked at the tie in Callie's hair. A gold charm dangled down from the elastic. She recognized the double C's of the Chanel logo. I know this sounds ludicrous, but that hair tie meant something to me. I usually had to get Rod's permission to buy a pack of gum. It was the first thing I bought on my own. And the reason was, he always made me wear my hair down. Always. He would spot check me at work. She gave a bitter laugh. So he broke into my apartment and stole it from me. Did the security cameras catch him? She shook her head. I never looked. I didn't want my super telling everyone in the building about the hysterical woman crying over a missing hair tie. Faith had assumed that a $6 million penthouse bought you some degree of indulgence. Callie said, That's how Rod always won. He made me feel crazy, like I couldn't tell anybody what was going on because they wouldn't believe me. Faith gently steered her back to the attack. You were hit in the head with a hammer. You were missing for 36 hours. You had... I had a gift. Her tone made it clear that she was certain of this one thing. Rod was going to drag me into court and air every single piece of our dirty laundry. And believe me, there's a lot. Not just about me, but about my family, my mother, her business. Rod wanted to burn all of us in effigy. But then, he gave me this gift, this abhorrent, savage gift, and I traded my silence for my freedom. Rod slithered back to Wyoming with nothing but the clothes on his back. I walked away with my life. Faith looked down at the glass in her hand. Callie Zanger sounded triumphant, avenged. But the more she talked, the more Faith was convinced that she was wrong. She tried, Do you remember how you got from your car to the woods? No. The doctor said that amnesia is normal after a significant blow to the head. She had finished her vodka. She motioned towards Faith's glass. I know what it looks like when someone is pretending to drink. Faith slid her glass toward Callie. She knew what it looked like when someone was an alcoholic. I remember waking up in the woods. Callie tossed back her head. Half the liquid disappeared. I woke up several times, actually. I don't know if it was the head wound or the shit he was forcing me to drink, but I kept falling asleep, waking up, falling asleep. What did he make you drink? Whatever it was,
It made me absolutely stoned. I was delirious. I couldn't control my thoughts. One minute I was terrified. The next I was floating in the ether. I couldn't move my arms and legs. I kept forgetting where I was. Even who I was.
Faith thought that sounded a hell of a lot like Rohypnol.
Did you recognize the taste?
Sure. It tasted like piss and sugar. I prefer this.
Callie raised the glass in a toast, then finished the vodka in one go. The alcohol seemed to catch up with her all at once. Her eyes turned glassy. She had trouble placing the empty glass flat on the counter. Faith reached over to help.
You know, it's bittersweet that Rod's downfall was the thing that made me fall in love with him in the first place, she explained. He always needed to control me. He couldn't just leave me there to die. He had to keep coming back. 3 or 4 times. I would wake up and he was there.
Did you see him?
Faith asked.
Did you see his face?
No. He was too careful. But I could sense it was him.
She slowly shook her head side to side.
He always loved watching me. When we first met, I thought it was unbearably sexy. I would go to the cafe or the library and see this tall, strapping cowboy hiding behind the corner with this intense look on his face.
Faith watched her bring the glass to her lips, then frowned to find it empty.
The bartender had disappeared into the kitchen.
Will sat at the bar, drinking a Coke, staring into the mirror.
When you're that young, you think that kind of behavior is desperately romantic. Now I realize he was stalking me.
She gave Faith a knowing look.
I figure it takes about 3 months of fucking you before a man really shows you how shitty he is.
Faith pushed her back into the woods.
What else do you remember?
She lazily rubbed her eyes. The vodka had made her loose.
Shadows. Leaves falling. The sound of Rod's cowboy boots getting caught in the mud.
It rained quite a lot while I was out there. I'm sure he planned it that way. She had asked a question Faith did not know how to answer. The hair tie, the woods, the Gatorade, the paralysis. Callie said,
I remember having this dream that he was brushing my hair. He started crying. Then I was crying. It was so strange because I felt at peace, you know? I was ready to give up. But I didn't. I wouldn't. And the best part is, it's all his fault. He really, really fucked up.
How?
Because he raped me.
She shrugged as if it was nothing.
He'd done it before. I mean, my God, how many times? So boring, Rod, get a new playbook.
Faith knew her matter-of-fact tone was a coping mechanism.
He waited until it was dark. I couldn't see his face. I couldn't move. I couldn't feel my skin. But my body started.
She raised herself up on the rungs of the barstool, then let herself down, then raised herself again, simulating the motions of sex.
And I remember thinking, this is the last time you are going to do this to me, Rodney Philip Zanger.
Callie shrugged it off again, but she was looking for the bartender. Faith said,
Callie, what?
What else, what else, what else?
She slurred the words together.
I spent 15 years of my marriage in training for the what else. Taking a punch. Learning how to pretend that my ribs weren't fractured, or my collarbone wasn't broken, or my ass wasn't bleeding.
Her hand went to her mouth, as if she'd said something comically inappropriate. Faith asked,
what else?
He finished raping me. He made me drink the stuff. I swallowed it. He left. I threw it up.
She smiled. Thank you, nasty teenage cunts at my boarding school, for teaching me how to vomit on command. Faith's throat felt like she had swallowed fire.
I must have sloughed out the lining of my stomach. That's how hard I threw up.
The pride in her voice was devastating.
It was such a weird color.
Her hand sloppily brushed the front of her blouse.
I had to get rid of my clothes. I mean, not that I'd want to keep them. But it looked like one of those guys from that group where they dance and there's drums. What's that group?
The one where they're blue. They played Vegas?
Blue Man Group.
Right. Callie searched for the bartender again.
I looked like I was gangbanged by the Blue Man Group.
She was laughing, but Faith could see the tears in her eyes.
Anyway, I puked it all out. I stood up.
I started walking.
Stumbling, really. My legs were like spaghetti. I found the road. This nice couple picked me up. My God, I felt bad about that. I looked a mess, and they were so worried. I tried to pay them afterward, a sort of reward for saving me, and they refused. And I kept pushing. And finally, they had me donate the money to their church building fund.
She told Faith,
it's a 501c3, but I didn't take the tax deduction. Shh, please don't tell anyone. My career would be over.
Faith tried to swallow the burning in her throat. She asked,
did Rod ever admit to you that it was him?
Again, she laughed.
Oh, hell no. He's too much of a coward. That's his deep, dark secret. That's why he beats women, because he's terrified of them. And now, he's terrified of me.
Faith gripped together her hands. Callie was clearly drunk. How could Faith tell this woman that her moment of triumph, her final revenge, was a lie?
Rod and I had this moment in my lawyer's office.
Callie turned toward Faith.
It was just the two of us. I told the lawyers to leave. I took my hair down. I shook it out like Cindy fucking Crawford. I said to Rod, your life is in my hands, asshole. I can destroy you with the snap of my fingers.
What did he say?
Oh, the usual. He called me a crazy bitch, kept insisting I was making the whole thing up.
But it was the look in his eyes. Callie pointed to her own eyes.
He was scared of me. His hands were shaking. He started groveling, begging me not to go to the police, whining about how he would never do anything like that. That he loved me. That he would never hurt me.
Her bitter laughter carried across the room.
You know what I said to him?
She clearly wanted a response. Faith had to swallow before she could ask,
what? I got in his face, looked him straight in his beady little pig eyes, and I said, I won.
She banged her fist on the bar.
Fuck you, Rod. I fucking won.
Chapter 23. Gina couldn't open her eyes. Or maybe she could open them, but she really did not want to. She'd forgotten what it felt like to sleep. Like, for real sleep? The way you slept when you were a kid, and you reached that sweet spot between puberty and college, and you could close your eyes and wake up at noon the next day in a state of full bliss. Where was she? Not where was she in the metaphoric sense. In the physical sense, like where the fuck was her body located on planet Earth right now? Her eyelids slitted open. Dusk, leaves, dirt, birds singing, trees swaying, insects insecting. Good God. Target's camping display was brilliantly realistic. She could practically smell s'mores cooking on an open flame. Or baked beans, like that scene in Blazing Saddles where they all started farting. Gina laughed. Then she coughed. Then she started to cry. She was lying on her back in the woods. She was bleeding where the hammer had cracked against her head. She was going to be raped. She needed to get the hell out of here. Why couldn't she move?
Gina had no understanding of anatomy, but there had to be a power line of some sort that plugged into her brain and went to her legs and made them move up and down or sideways so that she could roll over and stand up. Gina kept her eyes closed. She tried to clear her mind. She imagined the line, tried to send a current into the line. Wake up, line. Let's get some movement, line. Hello, line. I'm a lineman for the county. Oh, how her mother had laughed at Gina, praising REM for Wichita Lineman, when Glenn Close was the singer who'd made it famous. Glenn Close? Glenn Campbell. Had anyone seen Michael Stipe lately? He looked like Julian Assange had fucked the Unabomber. Gina's eyes flooded with tears. She was going to be raped. She was going to be raped. She was going to be raped. Why couldn't she move her legs? Her toes, feet, ankles, knees, fingers, elbows, even her eyelids. Nothing would move. Was she paralyzed? She could hear breathing. She didn't think the breaths were coming from her own lungs. Someone was behind her, sitting behind her. The man from the car, the one with a hammer. He was sobbing. Gina had seen an adult man cry exactly once in her life. Her father on 9/11. Gina had been at the library when the news broke about the first airplane. She had jumped into her car and driven to the safest place she knew, her parents' home. They had all huddled around the television, Gina, her mother and father. Her sister Nancy was in lockdown at work. Diane Sawyer was in her red sweater. They watched in horror as thousands of people were murdered in front of their eyes. Her father had held onto Gina, grabbed onto her like he was afraid to let her go. His tears had mixed with Gina's. Everyone had been crying. The entire country had wept. Her father was dead from lung cancer less than a year later. And now Gina was in the woods. The crying man was not her father. He was going to rape her. He had hit her with a hammer. He had taken her into the woods. He had drugged her. He was going to rape her. Gina had seen his face in the car. The memory tickled at the back of her brain. She could not summon his features, but a sense of familiarity was there. She'd seen him before. In the gym? At the store? Inside the office when she went in for monthly meetings? The face belonged to the man who had been watching her. He was the source of her paranoia. He was the person who had stolen her pink scrunchie from the bowl on the sink. He was the reason Gina had shut her blinds, checked her locks, hermited inside of her house. Nancy had no idea that Gina was missing. They had talked on the phone before Gina had left for the Target. Her sister called once a month, maybe? Her mother called once a week. But the last call was yesterday, so the next call would not be for another 6 days. 6 days. Her 12-year-old boss already had her Beijing report. He would email her. But Gina had trained him not to expect quick responses to his tedious emails because elderly people did not understand computers. Her nosy neighbor was not actually that nosy. The only person who would notice her absence was the Instacart delivery boy, and she knew that he was seeing other people. Gina's brain clicked back into the present. The man's sobs died out like water gurgling down a drain. He sniffed once, with finality. He was up, moving around. Then his knees dug into either side of her hips and he was on top of her. He was going to rape her. He was going to rape her. Gina felt his fingers dig into her cheeks. He was forcing open her mouth. She wanted to resist, but her muscles would not respond. She waited for his penis to be shoved down her throat. She braced herself. She prayed for strength, for a momentary surge of power that forced her jaw to clamp closed when he started to rape her. Plastic clashed against her teeth. He was holding a bottle to her lips. She coughed, then choked, then swallowed the liquid that filled her mouth. It tasted... What did it taste like? Sugar. Cotton candy.
urine. Her mouth was closed. The man moved off her. Her head was lifted up. He scooted around in the leaves. He let her head rest against his crotch. The back of her head, not the front. His semi-erect cock fingered against her neck. His legs rested along either side of her body. He had pulled her into his lap, like they were old lovers watching fireworks together on the 4th. Gina felt her scalp being tugged. Pressure against her head. A gentle, familiar scratching. The man was brushing her hair.
Chapter 24.
Sarah felt jittery as she walked into GBI headquarters. Lack of sleep was catching up with her. The hour and a half drive back from Grant County had stretched into 3 hours because of an accident and rush hour traffic. The monotony had lulled her into a state of semi-consciousness. Her clothes reeked of formaldehyde from Brock's warehouse and damp from the musty U store. She wanted desperately to get a coffee, but she was already running late. Sarah wrenched open the door to the stairs. Her brain felt as if it was pounding inside of her skull as she made her way up.
Dr. Linton.
Amanda was waiting for her on the first floor landing. She looked up from her phone.
Caroline put the Van Dorns in the conference room. Will and Faith are downtown interviewing a possible victim.
Sarah instantly thought of Tommy Humphrey.
What victim?
Kelly Zanger, tax lawyer. We'll get the details as they come.
Amanda started up the stairs.
I called the funeral home that handled Shay Van Dorn's body. They confirmed that she was buried in a composite vault, air sealed, as you mentioned. The parents are Amy and Larry. They divorced soon after Shay's death. Caroline told them that we were considering reopening the case, but she didn't specify why.
You didn't talk to them yourself?
Sarah stopped.
You let Caroline handle it?
Yes, Dr. Linton. It's easier to say you don't know the details when you actually don't know the details.
Amanda kept climbing.
Caroline says there's definitely some tension between them. You and I can work them together.
Sarah didn't express her distaste of the word work. The Van Dorns were grieving parents. Their child had unexpectedly died 3 years ago. Their marriage had broken apart shortly after. Sarah wasn't here to manipulate them. She was here to give them a choice. She told Amanda,
I'd like to speak to them alone.
Because?
Sarah was bone tired of confrontations.
Because I want to.
Your call, Dr. Linton.
Amanda already had her head buried in her phone as she took the next flight of stairs. Sarah rubbed her eyes. She could feel her mascara clumping. On the way to the conference room, she dashed into the bathroom to make sure she looked presentable. The mirror told her that she barely passed the mark, but at least her mascara hadn't turned her into a raccoon. Sarah splashed water onto her face. There was nothing she could do about the smell in her clothes. There was nothing she could do about any of this but knuckle through. She tried to brace herself as she headed toward the conference room. The Van Dorns both stood when Sarah opened the door. They had taken opposite sides of the long, wide conference table. Shay's parents did not look the way Sarah had expected. She had, for some reason, conjured the image of an older woman in a June Cleaver shirt dress and a suited man with a buzz cut. Amy Van Dorn was wearing a black silk blouse and black pencil skirt with heels. Her blonde-tipped hair was stylishly textured with a sweeping bang. Larry was in baggy jeans and a flannel work shirt. His hair was the color of dryer lint, longer than Sarah's, braided down the back. The divorced couple were the embodiment of city versus country folk. She said,
I'm Dr. Linton. I apologize for making you wait.
They all shook hands, made introductions, and studiously ignored the nervous tension in the room. Sarah had to sit at the head of the table so that she could address both of them at once. She reminded herself that the only thing she could do to make this slightly less painful was to get straight to the point. She said,
I'm a medical examiner for the state. I know Caroline told you that we are considering reopening your daughter's case. The reason for that is, in the course of reviewing the coroner's report regarding Shay's accident, I found some inconsistencies that...
I knew it, Larry!
Amy pointed her finger at her ex-husband.
I told you something wasn't right about that accident. I told you!
Larry had startled at the sound of Amy's voice. Sarah gave him a moment to recover before asking the woman, Is there a reason you don't agree with the coroner's finding?
Several.
Amy dove straight in.
Shay never went into the woods. Ever. And she was dressed for school. Why would she be out hiking when she had a class to teach? And why were her purse and phone locked in the trunk of her car? And then there was that creepy feeling she had. I know she dismissed it, but a mother knows when something is wrong with her daughter.
Sarah looked to Larry for confirmation. He cleared his throat.
Shay was depressed.
Amy crossed her arms.
She wasn't depressed. She was in transition. Every woman goes through a reckoning in their mid-30s. I did it. My mother did it.
Sarah could tell this was a familiar argument. She asked Larry, What was Shay depressed about?
Life, he guessed. Shay was getting older. Her job.